From the land to Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 15th day of December. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason coming to you from the I Hotel on campus at the U of I and the Certified Crop Advisors Conference. Coming up today, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Jim McCormick. He's at agmarket.net. We'll hear from Nick Sider. He made a presentation during the conference today as it's related to entomology, the western corn rootworm in particular, and some of the issues that Northern Illinois producers are having with that insect pest. And then as we wrap up our time together, we'll talk with Andrew Pritchard from Nutrien Ag Solutions about the weather forecast. He, too, was here at the Illinois Certified Crop Advisors Conference. And we'll do all of that on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is Public Radio for the farming world online at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, because of the timing of when I need to be on stage here at the Illinois Certified Crop Advisors Conference, I don't quite have the settlements for you, but I do have them just as they go into the close. March corn at 652 and three quarters, up 2.5. The May 2 higher at 653. In December, it's 598 and a quarter, up 2. January beans down 9 at 1473 and a quarter. The March at 1476 and a half, down 8 and a quarter. In November, 7 lower at 1386 and a quarter. And the bean meal at 455.20, down 480. Bean oil for the day, 20 cents higher at 63.7. The wheat futures up 6.25 at 755 and a half for the soft red, the hard red at 859, 8.75 of a cent higher for the day. Live cattle futures at 154.72 and a half, again going into their closes, 97 and a half cents lower. Feeders at 184.70, down 75, and lean hogs at 81.82 and a half, $1.57 and a half lower. Crude oil on the afternoon at $76.58 a barrel, down 70 cents. Diesel fuel or heating oil, a penny and 3 cents lower at $3.21 and a half, and gasoline at $2.18 and 8 cents, a nickel and a half lower for the day. Jim McCormick from AgMarket.net now joins us to take a look at what happened in Chicago at the CME Group for this Thursday. Hi, Jim. Thanks for filling in for Matt today. I appreciate that. I know you've been watching closely what's happening there in the marketplace. Why did corn rally and soybeans drop today?
I think the biggest thing you can argue the corn market rally has to do with the wheat market. The wheat market's had a really nice rebound off the morning lows, and I think that kind of brought the corn back up a little bit. The other thing, Todd, is we had a really good export sales today, 38 million bushels. That was above the expectation range of 20 to 35 million. And some of that sales was to China. So I think that added a little bit of positivity to the corn market as well.
I took a quick look at the numbers, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down sharply. What's happening with the numbers there?
Okay, what's happening in the numbers there is obviously we had the Fed come out yesterday. They raised interest rate a half point. We also had the European Union as well as the Great Britain do the exact same thing. But the biggest thing, Todd, was this market, the stock market specifically, has really been talking about the Fed pivot. You know, the idea that they're going to raise interest rates and then they're going to pivot and start cutting interest rates relatively quick into the latter half of 2023. Well, when Powell did his press conference yesterday, he made it very, very clear to the market that, hey, we're going to hold these interest rates up here. We understand the economy could suffer. We could see job losses, but the bigger fight is to get inflation under control. And it seemed like it took about 24 hours for the market to realize the Fed pivot that's been kind of giving the market a little bit of support may not be there. And I think that is causing today's washout. Technically, you took out some critical chart support as well, which is exasperating the move down.
And will the commodity markets be seen as a safe haven in that case and see an arbitrary bump in the marketplace eventually, do you suppose, or will it follow the Dow lower?
I think near term it could follow the Dow lower, you know, because partly you're seeing a little bit of movement, the dollar surging higher on this kind of news, so that's a little bit negative. But I think in the long run, you've got to be a little bit positive commodities going into 2023 in general. And the reason why I say that is China. China's been in this massive lockdown for the last couple of years due to COVID. Now they're essentially going from zero COVID, as we heard, all the way to, I'd call it 100 mile an hour COVID. They have essentially dropped all the guardrails. COVID, Todd, is ripping through their system right now. There's reports that trade desks, volume in China is down dramatically because there's just not enough traders to handle the volume because they're all sick with COVID. Kind of like that Omicron surge we had last fall. What I believe is going to happen is once you get through this surge over the next, it may last into January till we get past that, you know, that China holiday, New Year's holiday in January. But when we get over that hump, China is going to try to jack their, you know, kind of get their economy back up and running. And I think that could have an actually positive impact, not just on the grains, but pretty much all commodities as they try to spin their economy back up and try to get their GDP running. Because right now, estimates are it's going to be closer to 3%, way below their goal of 5 to 6%.
Are you of a mind that that will mean corn exports from the United States to China, or it will mean additional soybean exports? Usually, by the time we get to that point in the year, mid-January to February, they've already turned their attention southward.
It would be more likely to be corn exports than beans. Beans at this point in time are getting shifted over to Brazil. Interesting enough, there's estimates that China's already got 70 up to 75% of their Jan-Feb needs bought already. So yeah, so if we do get this economic rebound, it's more going to be for old crop corn. But that could be very, you know, kind of looking down the line, that could be positive for the overall demand going into 2023 for new crop. China, the last 3 months, actually imported a dang near 25 million metric tons of beans. That's near a record pace. The problem is their crush is down dramatically. So what we really need to see is their crush improve as we go into 2023. That'll help, you know, kind of overall increase the demand for beans. And maybe, like I said, increase the demand for beans we're going to be planting this spring and harvesting in the fall.
Have you thought much about the soy-corn ratio going into 2023, what it means for acreage and differences that producers might consider as they move forward into the calendar year?
I mean, it's going to be really interesting overall. I mean, I think a lot of guys are looking at it at the moment. I mean, I'm encouraging people to look at both, you know, you're looking at DEES 23 corn, just shy of $6 today. You're looking at NOV 23 beans, just shy of 14. I'm encouraging producers to actually take a look and go ahead and get it locked in. It really kind of depends on where you're at. I have some producers out west that say it just does not feasible to plant beans, and they're looking at planting corn. And then you got other guys in other parts of the country are more looking at beans. It just kind of depends on where you are in the basis and all that. But I think the crux that you want to encourage, that I want to encourage, Todd, to the listeners out there is, it's the profitability. It's not the price. It's not the ratio. It's like, what can you lock in the most profits in? Because I think the biggest fear we have right now as a whole is the macro economy slowing down. If the Chinese have a very big crop and looks like they have the capability of producing a big crop, and we happen to follow up with a very good crop in 2023, I just think, unfortunately, it's very highly unlikely we're going to be near $6 corn. We're probably closer to $5, maybe sub $5. And the same thing for beans. I know the UFI guys have done some pretty in-depth research projecting out prices into next year. And I know they're really not, you know, price positive, unfortunately, just simply because, you know, the dynamics are turning a little bit negative potentially.
So the risk management tools that producers can use would be forward cash sales, corn and soybeans for the 2023 crop. Of course, crop insurance, but we don't know what that crop insurance setting price will be until we get through the month of February. How do they manage the risk from this point until then?
Well, one thing you can do, I mean, you could sell the cash grain and maybe use an option. If you want to try to hedge off your risk on the crop insurance, something you might consider is the short-dated options. The short-dated options are valued off the new crop price. So if you bought a short-dated corn, it's based off of, you know, essentially the December futures price, or the short-dated beans option, which is for the March timeframe, it's based off the November. If you look at the March, Todd, they expire like 2 days before the last two trading days of February. So if you bought those puts, they would essentially allow you to put a floor in place to know where your worst case scenario is until that crop insurance floor is set. So that's one way to lay off some of that risk.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you.
That's Jim McCormick. He is with AgMarket.net. Let's continue now our conversations from the Illinois CCA Certified Crop Advisors Conference taking place at the IA Hotel all day today. Nick Sider made a presentation during the day, of course, about entomology, the Western corn rootworm in particular. What were your points of discussion with the crowd today?
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about, first, the situation with Western corn rootworm and BT resistance, and then talking about the composition of some new trait packages that are are coming in that have RNA interference or RNAi technology, and how that kind of fits into the corn rootworm management scenario, how RNAi works in combination with BT, and what we need to do to sort of preserve those trait packages long term.
Let's do talk about the western corn rootworm, particularly in the northern part of the state, I believe, where again it has been adapting to the control measures that producers have used for the last couple of decades now.
What sectors we find is that they're becoming more and more adept at overcoming pyramided BT trait packages, especially in areas where we have a lot of corn after corn. And so those areas in northern Illinois, like into DeKalb County, Kane County, Ogle County, Stevenson County, where we've got a lot of corn following corn, especially long term, that's where we've seen a lot of trait failures over the last few years. And if you throw the same thing at this particular pest over and over and over again, it overcomes it every single time. Doesn't matter if it's a BT trait, a soil insecticide, even crop rotation, it's just really adaptive, really good at overcoming these different controls.
On that crop rotation thing, it does still work in central Illinois, though.
Yeah, correct. And what we're finding is even in areas where historically we've had a lot of rotation resistance, that crop rotation is keeping that overall population down. We're at lower levels than we once were. And so we've got a really big difference right now in Illinois between areas where we're primarily rotated, where we have very few rootworm problems at all, and areas where we have a lot of continuous corn, where in some cases we're really struggling to control them.
What are the new solutions that are being put into the marketplace?
Yeah, so the new solutions work through RNA interference. So instead of having a BT protein, well, in addition to a BT protein, these trait packages will have double-stranded RNA. When that insect feeds on that double-stranded RNA, it actually goes through a process called RNA interference that silences production of the protein that RNA codes for. Well, in this case, that corn plant is expressing double-stranded RNA that codes for a protein that the corn rootworm naturally produces, that it needs it. And so when that rootworm feeds on that material, it silences production of its own proteins. That'll kill the insect, but it does kill the insect a little bit more slowly than a BT trait will. So it works best in combination with an effective BT protein, which will stop the insect from feeding immediately. And then the RNAi trait will stop those insects that survive that BT protein from surviving to adulthood and passing along its genes. That's ideally how this will work.
Do you have advice for producers who are interested in this and deploying it?
Yeah, absolutely. Hope they will deploy it, especially in areas where they're struggling a little bit with corn rootworm. What I don't want them to do is put that stuff in the same field year after year after year, continuous corn production. We already know how that story ends. We already know what that's going to do. Use it judiciously. Use it in combination with crop rotation, if at all possible. Help to keep that beetle population down. Every time we've lost one of these trait packages for corn rootworm, we've lost it first in areas that have long-term continuous corn production. That's what's putting the most selection pressure on this insect. That's what we want to avoid getting into with these new trait packages. We want them to last for a good long time. You know, we want to be able to use these tools for a good long time.
So I do want to take you back a couple of decades ago to a conversation that was taking place and wondering whether this is something producers can, should consider at this point, when these were first introduced, always in a block, and then, or leaving a block where there just wasn't any kind of control method available to try to make sure that there was a set of western corn rootworm that did not develop resistance. And then, of course, it was in the bag, and so it was just scattered throughout the field. Is there any thought about what producers can, should do, or might think about if they're really concerned about these issues?
Yeah, and so the refuge for these will be mixed into the bag. Certainly doesn't hurt to have some non-BT out there that's treated with an insecticide somewhere as some variation in your approach. Ultimately, it's like with anything else, we don't want to rely too much on any one control tactic. What we've seen with the refuge in a bag in general. For corn rootworm, it seems to be pretty effective. The one maybe caveat on that amount of refuge is a lot lower than it used to be. And from a resistance management standpoint, yeah, it would be better if that refuge percentage was a little bit higher. Of course, from an economic management standpoint, maybe less so. So there is a little bit of headbutting, I guess you'd say, between those two aspects.
This is a new product on the marketplace. Are there any other new products that will be coming down the road for control of the Western corn rootworm that you're aware of?
Sure. So there's two additional trait packages that have that RNAi technology, but ultimately it's the same RNAi trait. So we'll have some different trade names to it. That's going to be Vorseed Enlist, and it's going to be VT4Pro, but it's the same trait. So it's the same trait with a different name. So yeah, there's some additional BTs as well down the road, but I'm not sure when to expect those.
Thank you very much, Nick.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Nick Sider is an extension entomologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We're spending the day at the CCA, the Certified Crop Advisors Conference, here at the I Hotel. I've been moderating mostly a glorified timekeeper's position to make sure everything stays on time and that I'm out of the way. Early in the morning, Andrew Pritchard presented. He's part of Nutrien Ag Solutions and one of the senior meteorologists there. What were the discussion points you put forward to this group of folks that are out in the field every day in Illinois?
Well, I operate daily in the world of weather risk, high-impact disruptive weather. So I want to start off talking about some of the different weather risks that we see in production agriculture, from the small-scale acute weather risk to the long-term, widespread, chronic weather risks that we see. Then I want to talk about the jet stream, the patterns that we're typically watching for some of these problematic patterns. You know, during some of these crucial parts of the growing season, the summer ridge, when we're seeing heat and dryness, some of the things that we're looking at, you know, in advance, in months leading up to that, so that we can help kind of understand the things that lead to these patterns and what we meteorologists are looking at behind the scenes as we try and understand where the weather pattern is going several weeks or several months down the road.
Can you begin by telling me a little bit about the westerlies and what that jet stream means?
Sure, everything comes down to the jet stream, and you know, specifically, we look over the Pacific Ocean a lot of the time to see what the jet stream is going to be doing for us upstream across North America. So that means we're looking at, you know, things like La Nina. Those are, you know, sea surface temperature anomaly differences. We're looking at the Madden-Julian oscillation. All of these are things that impact the flow, the intensity, the shape of the jet stream, and you know, by understanding that, we can get a better idea of the impacts that we'll be, you know, experiencing here across the North America, across the Midwest and the Corn Belt.
Things changed then across the Western Corn Belt. I do want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, which is a ridge that builds during the summer months. It tends to oscillate. How much difference does it make where it begins to build?
It makes all the difference where that ridge begins to build. And, you know, this past year we saw that with the early dryness coming out of the winter across the southern plains. That gave us some concern that we might see a feedback there as we got into the spring and then, you know, the early part of the summer, where we might see heat and dryness begin to crop up in those areas. And then that starts to build that ridge in across, you know, parts of the central United States, which is obviously problematic then for the key parts of the summer, the growing season here in the Midwest. So it makes all the difference in the world whether that ridge is setting up early across the central U.S. or further to the west across the Pacific Northwest, parts of western Canada, such as we saw in 2021, a much more favorable growing season across the central U.S., all coming down to the position of that ridge.
As a meteorologist, how much do you defer to climatology as it relates, for instance, to the long-term drought in the western United States?
Yeah, we're definitely always looking at climatology, and we're trying to understand where the weather patterns are going, where some of these, you know, climatology is changing all of the time. So we can't always just lean on the same climatology. So we're always reassessing those. Every decade, we get a new set of climate normals here, and we can understand where things are gradually changing, where things maybe are more quickly changing. And some of the you know, we're seeing some feedbacks here where more typically we're seeing that ridge set up across the western United States, which is clearly problematic for them, but maybe beneficial for us here across the Corn Belt, keeping us, you know, shielded from those prolonged periods of excessive heat, the prolonged periods of dryness. So we're always leaning on climatology because, you know, that's our our bumpers there, and it helps us get an idea of what's typical, and then we can start to work in some of the other factors, our La Nina, the MJO. What are going to be some of the wild cards that might interfere with a pattern like that?
Tell me about the patterns that you're watching now as it relates to spring weather.
Yeah, right now we're watching La Nina. That's the phrase that we're throwing around a lot, and that's because we're in a third straight year of La Nina. And last year we expected that to fade as we came out of the winter into the early spring. That didn't happen. La Nina re-intensified, and here we are, a third straight winter. Now all signs point toward La Nina fading, going neutral as we head toward the spring, maybe even overcorrecting into El Nino as we get into next winter. But that transition from La Nina toward a neutral phase there with the ENSO, that gives us an idea. It gives us some years that we can look back on and understand that in past years, when we came out of maybe a second or a third La Nina transition to neutral conditions, what happened? What was the sequence events there? And that gives us a bit of a starting point here for what we might expect several months down the road. So we're watching that for moisture across California. Certainly transitioning out of La Nina would be great news in the West. We would really amp up the jet stream, get some more moisture, laden storm systems to work through there. That would also be great news for the southern plains, starting to bring some storm systems in there, similar to the one we saw this week. Widespread heavy rain across the south, heavy snow across the northern plains. That's exactly what the doctor ordered through the rest of the winter.
What will you be watching very closely in those areas this winter, and what will give you signs that the La Nina is not waning?
We're watching sea surface temperatures across the equator, the equatorial Pacific specifically, kind of between South America and Northern Australia. So we're watching the colder ocean temperatures there. That's how we can see the La Nina. And what's really happening is it's stronger trade winds across the equator that are upwelling that colder water from the deep ocean. So we're watching the trade winds. We're watching the ocean temperatures, watching for warming. We're watching for a weakening of those trade winds. Both of those would signal La Nina beginning to pull back. Once we start to warm up those ocean temperatures there, that allows the subtropical jet stream to sort of reinvigorate. And that's that southern branch of the jet stream that we need to bring more impactful storm systems into the west, to bring heavier precipitation then into the southern plains.
Are you concerned about summer weather yet? And I'm doubtful that's the case for the Midwest. Are there any indications?
For now, I would say that, you know, there's concern in the back of our minds, and that's because we have drought now. So the important thing is going to be, what do things like the drought monitor look like in April? What does our soil moisture look like in April? We'll be able to get a better understanding of how concerned we are coming into the summer once we know, did we get this transition out of La Nina? Have we kind of resaturated the soils across the southern U.S.? If we come out of winter into the early part of the spring, we've got a lot of dry soils across the central and southern plains. That's going to start to raise that concern for drought as we head into the summer.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Andrew Pritchard joined us here on the Closing Market Report. Of course, he kicked off the CCA, the Certified Crop Advisors Conference, in Champaign, Illinois at the I Hotel early this morning in the 8 o'clock hour. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org.